It is Sunday, July 5th. We are looking at a country that feels increasingly like it is running on fumes. From the long-term decay of our national institutions to the way we are letting algorithms dictate our health, today is about the structural cracks we usually ignore. The United States is approaching its 250th anniversary. It is arriving at this milestone with significantly less national optimism than it did for the bicentennial in 1976. The country is grappling with practical issues like extreme heat, but the overarching trend is a steady breakdown of the two-party system. Institutional cohesion is weakening. The traditional divide between the Republican and Democratic parties is loosening, which is creating room for internal struggles and the rise of fringe groups. These groups prioritize social media attention over historical norms. Future political power will likely migrate toward those working outside established party structures. They are using digital platforms to build followings centered on populist rhetoric rather than concrete party platforms. This instability is compounded by a shift in presidential standards regarding personal wealth. The current administration has seen unprecedented wealth accumulation and complex conflicts of interest. This marks a departure from the long-standing expectation that public service should be kept separate from private gain. It sets a dangerous precedent. Future leaders may now view the presidency as a vehicle for building personal wealth, which will almost certainly continue to erode public trust in the federal government. In Iran, the government is navigating a period of intense internal scrutiny regarding succession. While Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, pronounced Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, remains in power, the regime is currently managing significant speculation about the future of the clerical hierarchy. There are reports of citizens who view the leadership as a primary source of long-term trauma, which signals a deep divide between the government and its people. Meanwhile, foreign delegations from countries like Saudi Arabia have been observed in diplomatic discussions with Iranian officials. Their engagement is a notable shift, given the history of opposition between these two nations. It points toward a fragile, pragmatic realignment in regional power, even as the underlying tensions remain unresolved. Looking at the big picture, these events paint a portrait of a world in a volatile transition. We have internal political division and the decline of institutional norms colliding with major climate disruptions. Traditional methods of political unity are failing to bridge the widening ideological and socioeconomic gaps. It is a hell of a thing to watch in real time. We are talking about the erosion of the very structures that are supposed to keep the lights on and the ship moving. When you look at the rise of the digital populist model, it's clear that parties are no longer the gatekeepers of power. They are becoming more like legacy media brands that people only visit when they want to be angry. The shift in how we view wealth in the White House is particularly damaging. We spent decades assuming that the people in charge would at least pretend to separate their bank accounts from their policy decisions. That norm is effectively dead. Once you normalize using the highest office in the land as a personal piggy bank, you don't really get to walk that back. It's not just a breach of etiquette. It is a fundamental change in the incentive structure for anyone who wants to run for office. As for what is happening in Tehran, the regime is clearly trying to project an image of stability to both their citizens and the world. Watching Saudi officials engage with a leadership they spent years opposing is the kind of cynical pragmatism that usually precedes a major shift in the balance of power. It makes you wonder what they know that the rest of us are still trying to figure out. Anyway, the common thread here is the decay of the old guard. Whether it's the two-party system in Washington or the clerical hierarchy in Iran, the institutions that define the last 50 years are struggling to survive the next five. It's not just a bad news cycle. It's a structural pivot. We are living through a period of persistent friction, and frankly, I don't see anything on the horizon that suggests we are about to hit the reset button. Speaking of being monitored, the way we handle data isn't just a government problem. It is seeping into how we manage our own biology. Artificial intelligence is changing the way medicine identifies disease. Instead of waiting for physical symptoms to appear, new diagnostic tools now scan for microscopic anomalies to predict health risks years in advance. This shift moves us from reactive care to a model of total body surveillance. Proponents argue that early detection is the only way to significantly lower mortality rates. They point to data, which some researchers contest, suggesting that 80% of averted cancer deaths since 1975 resulted from early screening rather than advanced therapies. The logic here is that by using AI to analyze patterns like methylation signatures in liquid biopsies, doctors can catch diseases that were previously considered untreatable. But here is the catch. This increased sensitivity is triggering what experts call a diagnostic cascade. Because these tools are designed to be hypersensitive, they often flag slow-growing, indolent conditions that would never have shortened a patient's lifespan. We have seen this play out in global thyroid screening initiatives, where massive spikes in detection and surgery resulted in zero improvement in overall mortality rates. Patients are being subjected to invasive procedures and long-term psychological stress for conditions that might never have harmed them. It is a hell of a way to practice medicine, turning healthy people into patients based on a computer's prediction of a future that might never arrive. The problems here go well beyond the exam room. Once an AI flags a biological risk, that information enters a permanent, legally usable record. This creates a massive vulnerability for patients when it comes to their finances. Current legal protections, like the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, contain significant loopholes for life, disability, and long-term care insurance. That means insurance companies can potentially use these preemptive AI flags to either inflate your premiums or deny you coverage entirely. It is the kind of situation that makes you wonder who exactly is being served by this technology. The patient is supposedly getting a head start on their health, but the insurer is getting a head start on their bottom line. There is also a psychological toll that is harder to quantify, but just as real. When people are constantly monitored and told about every minor structural flaw in their bodies, they start to change how they live. This leads to what is being called the worried well. People start interpreting normal, everyday bodily sensations as evidence of decay. They stop living like healthy, functioning adults and start acting like people in a perpetual state of sickness. It creates a feedback loop of medical reliance, where the algorithm effectively manages your life by keeping you in a constant state of pre-patient anxiety. Look, the reality is that the traditional gatekeeper of the physical symptom has been dismantled. If we have the capability to identify every potential future ailment, we have to decide where the boundary between health and pathology actually sits. If we don't set those limits, we are looking at a future where the entire population is relegated to a state of algorithmically managed pre-patient status. It is a massive shift in the social contract of medicine. We are trading the peace of mind that comes with being healthy for the illusion of control that comes with being monitored. I'm not sure that is a trade we should be making without a hell of a lot more skepticism about who is actually holding the data. That obsession with data and control is everywhere, even in places where you would think gut instinct still mattered, like at the track. The United States government effectively hit the pause button on October 24, 1877. Congress adjourned, the stock board closed, and even the corn and flour exchange stopped operations. The reason for this total institutional standstill was a match race at Pimlico between two horses, 10 broke and parole. Senators from Kentucky, Illinois, and Pennsylvania were all at the track, turning a sporting event into a national focal point that completely overrode legislative and commercial duties. It was a massive spectacle, but the New Orleans Times-Picayune was not buying it. They pointed out that while everyone was watching the horses, the army remained unpaid and the seating of Louisiana representatives was delayed. It is a hell of a thing to watch the machinery of government grind to a halt because everyone wanted to see if Ten Broke could beat the favorite. He did, by the way, earning $30,000 for his owner, Frank Harper. The crowd was so whipped up by the win that they apparently tried to carry the horse. Fast forward to today, and the sport is dealing with a different kind of pressure. Magnitude is currently the top horse in the older horse division after winning the Stephen Foster. This has put a massive target on his back and forced a reckoning for horses like Sovereignty. Sovereignty has been underperforming, and the upcoming Whitney race is essentially his last stand. If he doesn't show up, he is likely headed for retirement. That is how the industry works now. Owners are increasingly choosing to protect a horse's legacy rather than keep them running as secondary competitors. Beyond the individual stars, the sport is struggling to manage the basics. Extreme heat is forcing tracks to constantly rethink their schedules and safety protocols. There is a real tension here between the desire to keep a race card intact and the physical reality of running animals at high speeds in dangerous temperatures. Trainers are leaning on more cooling methods, but it feels like a band-aid on a structural problem. The industry is at least making some progress on the infrastructure side. Tracks are moving toward flexible, modular safety rails instead of the old, rigid aluminum versions. These new rails are designed to flex and redirect horses and riders away from the infield during a crash, which is a significant step forward for basic safety. Finally, the race for the Eclipse Award is still wide open. Jose Ortiz is the current favorite after wins at the Kentucky Derby and Belmont Stakes, but his lead is not locked in. Voters tend to favor a full season of work over a few big wins, so a strong fall campaign from a rival could easily flip the result. It is a reminder that in this sport, the scoreboard never tells the whole story. Success is a fragile mix of health, luck, and knowing when to quit while you are ahead. The track is a closed loop, but the business of telling stories about it and everything else is changing fast. We are seeing a total collapse of the old gatekeeper model. Village Media has moved away from subscription-based models to focus on mass reach and community integration. The company now treats local businesses as its primary financial partners instead of chasing reader subscriptions. This shift changes the publisher's role from a news gatekeeper to a facilitator of local commerce. The numbers here are telling. Many traditional publishers struggle to convert readers into subscribers, often capturing only 8 to 12% of a population. Village Media, however, generates about 70% of its revenue from direct local sales. They achieve this by providing businesses with direct access to a mass local audience through sponsored journalism and proprietary marketing dashboards. This is a hell of a pivot. It effectively treats the newsroom as a piece of infrastructure for social and commercial interaction rather than a standalone product. By focusing on service journalism, covering school boards, city councils, and community events, the organization becomes a daily utility. The result is a high engagement model that creates a scalable audience, which is exactly what local businesses are looking for. Here is the thing about the legacy media mindset. When publishers talk about news deserts, they usually frame it as a problem of dying institutions. Village Media suggests they are looking at it all wrong. Many of these deserts exist because the incumbent media failed to evolve with the market. Success is not about saving old models or building walls around content. It is about identifying communities with a strong sense of identity and building lean, digital infrastructure that actually reflects how people consume information today. But don't mistake this for some passive digital strategy. It requires serious operational discipline. Because the model relies on direct local sales, it necessitates a heavy investment in boots on the ground. You cannot just launch a website and hope for the best. Expansion is limited by the ability to execute, not just the availability of a market. Organizations that fail to combine a newsroom providing service journalism with a sales force that understands local business needs are likely facing high churn and low impact. It is a refreshingly pragmatic take on a dying industry. For years, the industry narrative has been that readers must pay for news or journalism will cease to exist. Village Media is arguing that the model is the problem, not the reader's willingness to open their wallet. If you treat the entire community as your audience and monetize that reach through local partnerships, you stop trying to rescue an old, broken ship and start building something that actually functions in the current economy. It is not a magic bullet, obviously. It is hard work. It requires moving away from the vanity of legacy prestige and toward the utility of being a town square. But looking at the numbers, it is difficult to argue with the results. If the goal is to keep local journalism alive, maybe we should stop trying to gate it and start figuring out how to make it useful to the people who actually live there. Making that model work requires a hard look at the ledger. If you are building a business, you have to stop praying and start looking at the cash flow. Founders moving from digital products to physical inventory face a cash flow trap. Physical goods require capital to be tied up in manufacturing and shipping for long periods before a sale occurs. If a founder ignores the timeline between paying a manufacturer and collecting revenue, they risk insolvency regardless of sales volume. Effectively, money trapped in inventory is dead capital that cannot be used for growth. The fix here is shifting from fixed costs to variable ones. Relying on third-party logistics providers keeps a business agile by avoiding the overhead of long-term warehouse leases. Once a founder masters these supply chain mechanics, it actually becomes a competitive advantage. It is a moat that is difficult for rivals to copy. Honestly, it is just boring math, but boring math is what keeps a business alive. Moving over to retirement planning, the standard rules of thumb are failing people. Guidelines like the 4% withdrawal rate do not account for local costs of living or individual life paths. Many digital calculators rely on optimistic market return projections of 8 to 10%, which masks the reality of potential downturns. Using lower, more conservative projections, like 5 or 6%, creates a necessary margin of safety. Financial independence is a dynamic system, not a static target you hit once. Most people need to move beyond simple spreadsheets and toward active risk management. This is where professional advice becomes useful. It is not just about the numbers, but about having a guardrail against panic selling during market volatility. Tools like Projection Lab or hourly planners can replace the set it and forget it mindset. If your plan relies on the market always going up, you do not actually have a plan. You have a prayer. And if you are looking for a prayer, you can find plenty of those in the social media feeds that claim we are all just manifestations of the soul. A few other things worth knowing today. First, look, there is this argument floating around the digital social hour that reality is just a projection of the soul. It claims our inherent authority stands above any government system, which is a hell of a thing to say with a straight face while you are paying taxes like the rest of us. In international soccer, teams playing at high altitudes like Azteca Stadium are changing how they approach the game. The thin air makes it impossible to sustain a high-intensity press, so teams are playing much more conservatively to survive. That shift towards survival soccer creates some real problems for squads built around aging stars. When you build a team entirely around someone like Cristiano Ronaldo, you hit a structural bottleneck. You lose your cohesive attacking plan, and you become remarkably easy to predict. Argentina is running into a similar wall right now. They are relying almost entirely on set pieces and individual flashes from Lionel Messi to compensate for a lack of tactical width. It works for surviving a single match when the legs are tired, but relying on magic to fix a structural imbalance is a shitty long-term strategy. That is the state of things this Sunday morning. Try to keep your head on straight, and I will see you tomorrow.